How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.
Hey, everybody. We are back. It is Mike and Woody with episode 20 of The WOW here on August 19th.
Yes. And tomorrow I get on a plane to Atlanta, Hotland, all right? Working on a cold case with a family out there. And it's horrible. And it's hot. It really will be hot Atlanta, but August is almost over, right?
Yeah, well, is it in the city or is it outside of the city?
Well, I could have done it anywhere, but I got a suite at a hotel near the airport. I don't plan on leaving the hotel. I've done Atlanta way too many times, and I'll spend 4 or 5 days recording with them or however long it takes till I get done. Then I fly back on Saturday morning to New Orleans, get off the plane at 9 o'clock and get on another plane at noon to fly to San Diego to go see my grandbaby for the first time.
Oh, good. I didn't know how quickly you were getting out there. You can't go direct from New Orleans to San Diego, can you?
Yeah, they have one, but I don't have it. I have a layover, and there's one on, I think, Southwest or something, but I didn't take that. I took the one with the layover in Houston so I can get my Platinum American Express use out of the lounge on the way out.
You're going to be jet lag. You're just going to be
hungover.
You're going to have had enough of airplanes and bad airplane food or whatever by then. But well, folks, we've got another segment of Nittany Lion coming at you here today. And I wanted to say a couple things before we got into it. If you listened last week, Woody encouraged me to get involved with the forum on the Real Life Real Crime app. And I did this week. I got pummeled a little bit, but it was fun. And I just want to make sure that everybody knows that we are totally in sync with what we are doing. Woody is looking at the investigation as it was conducted by Ziegler and as we shared it in the podcast, and questioning me on some things he would have done differently or things he sees very differently than we see them. And we're talking those things out, and it's all good between us. We're trying to find the right cadence of how much information to share before I sort of check back in with Woody. So today we're going to try and do that a little bit more often, so you're not hearing me talking 90% of the time. And so hopefully it goes a little bit better than that. But before we get there, we got a couple other stories to share.
Hey, before you start, I have a thought and I want to kind of throw this down to you. So because it's so long and, you know, you promise you're going to change my mind by the end of it, et cetera. Continue to do what we do. But when we get done with everything, if you haven't changed my mind, I want to do an episode where I present questions to you. Maybe you get Zig on. Maybe we do a three-way. And I present questions to y'all from my point of view. And we'll have it out that way. Not have it out, but, you know, they get... That way, they can't always say that it was just you talking over me or whatever. And because it's so much when we're doing it, I have so many thoughts. And if I don't say it right when it's on the tip of my tongue, then I'll lose it because I get fixated on the next thing that's said or whatever. So in the end, if my mind isn't changed, let's do in an episode where I bring to the table everything that I, you know, have done, and we'll cover it for everyone. Deal.
I love that. And I'll make the same offer to you that I made to somebody on the forum, which is if you're not convinced by the end, I will make a $1,000 donation to the charity of your choice. And so you're not convinced, somebody will win and get a little something for their charity. But before we get into it today, cool. We've got a couple of other stories. And the first one is about what's going on in New York with ghost license plates. And this one really speaks to me because I don't know if you have this problem up in your area, Woody, but it is ridiculous in New Orleans with all of these cameras and these, you know, getting a speeding ticket for doing 34 and a 30 or 33 and a 30 or 28 and a 25 or going through a yellow and getting caught by a red light. It's ridiculous. And, you know, on the interstate system or even highways, there's sort of this understood thing where, you know, if it says 65 and you're doing, you know, 71, you're probably okay. North of 75, you're probably in trouble. You know, there's a little fudge, there's a little bit of room. But this thing with the government watching your every move, and if you're 2 miles, 3 miles above the speed limit, sending you a $75 ticket. I mean, come on, it's bullshit. In New York, I didn't realize, because when I lived there, none of this, obviously the tech wasn't there yet either, but none of this was going on. And so I found this story where ghost license plates are costing New York City $200 million a year, according to the governor's office, the mayor's office. And that is fueled by a growing online cottage industry that's peddling what they call James Bond level gadgets. I don't have a James Bond level gadget, but I need to get one. So yeah. The rogue vehicles whiz through tolls and past NYPD speed and red light cameras 100,000 times a month, using their unreadable plates to dodge fines and other penalties, according to the New York mayor and the Manhattan borough president, whose name is Mark Levine. Ghost plate scourge involves driving without a plate altogether or using tags that are scratched out or obscured by tinted or reflective covers or are completely phony. In the most sophisticated case I've seen, there's actually a gadget you can buy in the Facebook marketplace that you hit a button on a key fob and there's like a little garage that closes on your license plate. You press the button and it lowers like a garage door over your license plate. So they are, the analysis by the Manhattan borough president's office found that more than 5% of all vehicles passing by the city's Department of Transportation, MTA, and Port Authority cameras a month are now unreadable. Well, that's too low. They need to get it, because 95% are still readable. They need to get that number up. They estimate $200 million worth of uncollected tickets and tolls. Now, I don't agree with anybody doing this to skip a toll. A toll is a toll. You're going on a bridge, you owe a toll or a tunnel. That's bull. But if it's over 2 miles an hour on a road, you know, I got a bone to pick with you. So a joint operation by the MTA and the New York Police Department last month snared 200 motorists, including a career criminal with a loaded pistol who's a suspect in the 2005 murder. So I guess chasing down these people is helping them find some people who've committed more serious crimes. But we're seeing James Bond level technology where they push a button to drop down a cover. I talked to you about that. The Post also found authority thwarting reflective license plate covers openly for sale on Facebook Marketplace under names such as, quote, toll cheat plate cover for up to $60 a pop. There needs to be a severe crackdown on these fake plates and obscuring devices online. Dozens of city council members last year urged the U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg to enact reforms aiming to curb the sale of fraudulent paper license plates sold in other states and increasingly seen in the city. Well, I got a quick answer for you. Do this fairly and have these cameras work off of giving the driver a little bit of a fudge against these speed limits. And then you won't have to worry about a cottage industry to avoid this stuff. If you're doing 45 in a 30, you deserve a ticket. If you're doing 80 in a 65, you deserve a ticket, but not for just a couple miles an hour.
Let me tell you about that, because these were the first tickets I couldn't get fixed. And now you can't get any tickets fixed, period, because everything's computerized. They enter your license plate, whatever. Although I did get stopped a couple weeks ago on the way to Alexander, and I just got a warning once they find out who I was. But so these systems are actually run by independent companies, and they pay a post-certified police officer to verify that there is an actual violation, like sit down on their days off and watch these cars that, you know, violate, and they sign off on it, right? But there's the company that produces these cameras and maintains them, et cetera, and pays the officer. It gets a certain percentage, and the city gets a certain percentage. So it's automatic. There's no leeway in it. You're screwed. And that's actually been challenged. A good buddy of mine, Sheriff Leland Falcons, the sheriff of Assumption Parish, when he found out that one of the towns had put them in, he made them take it out He said, I don't think it's fair. You know, you catch an 82-year-old grandma going to the grocery store. She's going 2 miles an hour over the speed limit. And you get her one way, it's a $200 ticket. And you catch her coming back. And then in the same day, how is she going to pay a $400 ticket for going 2 miles an hour over in a 25, right? I don't really agree with it. I agree with you on tolls. Do you know that there's not a toll road in the state of Louisiana? And there never was, except for the bridge, the Crescent City Connection used to have it coming from the east bank to the west bank. And there was a dollar a time until the bridge was paid for and they took it down. So not a toll road.
Wow. I did not
know
that.
Now that's probably why Louisiana's roads are so fucked up and the traffic's so bad. But I lived in Dallas, you know, and you can toll road shit out of it, right? And the high speed, you know, double occupancy lane and all that stuff, and people putting dummies in the car and shit like that. And crooks are going to be crooks. People are always going to try to find a way to fight the system.
No, it's crazy. I was renting a car for my wife for Dallas, Fort Worth this week. Mm-hmm. And they offer you the, whatever they call it in Texas, the toll tag.
Yep.
And the way they offer it to you is unlimited usage for $12 a day.
Yeah.
$12 a day.
Right. Like you're going to use it that much.
So wait a minute. If you drive so she's there 5 days, $60 worth of tolls for just driving on the roads in Texas no wonder they don't need a state income tax.
Right. Or inspection stickers or whatever. Right. But I mean, it is what it is. And that's kind of like the rental car companies offering you to, fill up your car on return so you don't have to mess with it for like $10 a gallon, which I used to take when I was doing it for companies because I didn't want to have to find a gas station and fill the fucker back up. But it is what it is. But let me tell you a horrific case, y'all. And, you know, when I was a boy, I got my first BB gun and my daddy taught me how to shoot it. And it probably wasn't a month later, he caught me shooting all the windows out of the barn and he beat my ass and took the gun away from me forever. I still don't know where the BB gun is, but this is not that kind of story. In Michigan, a mother by the name of Elena Rose Jennings, who's 25, and her boyfriend, Daniel John Giacchina, 32, have been charged with murder after her 6-year-old son, Giovanni Chulo Jennings, was found unconscious with injuries all over his body on July the 30th. Now, police say that young Chulio died after being stapled to a wall and shot with a BB gun, all part of the horrific abuse by his mother and her boyfriend. Now, the abuse was allegedly often carried out in front of their other kids. And investigators learned that Giovanni had been confined to a pen and left to sleep on a wooden slat in his mom's bedroom in their mobile home in Madison Heights. As we carefully sifted through the evidence, what we found can only be described as horrific, Oakland County prosecutor said. Chulo was beaten by Giacchini on multiple occasions. And while that abuse sometimes happened while Jennings was at work, Jennings was aware of it and approved of the physical assaults, and at times even encouraged Giacchini to abuse Chulio. According to prosecutors, a black curtain and barricades were installed on the pen to keep Giovanni inside, and a security camera was installed so Giacchini and Jennings could monitor what they mom called misbehaving, including Chulio trying to urinate, drink, or leave the corner. Giacchini then stapled Giovanni's clothes to the wall to keep him confined in a corner with his face wedged into the corner of the wall, and even sent Jennings a photo to laugh about it. Jennings and Giacchini laughed about the photo, and Giacchini's use of the staple gun to solve the problem, McDonald said. Police were finally called to the home on July 30th, and the boy died at a local hospital the next day. And an autopsy showed injuries across his body, including to his scalp, temples, lips, inner mouth, cheeks, forehead, chin, shoulders, forearms, fingers, thumbs, back, butt.
Jesus.
There's nothing else you got unless you say a fucking fingernail. But it was clear from the evidence that we saw that there was a pattern of abuse that led to Chulo's death, according to McDonald. and that's what he said of the murder charges. A staple gun, a BB gun, and CO2 cartridges were among items seized from the home. Police said they also found a 9mm ghost gun and over 100 rounds of 9mm ammunition, as well as photos of the children posing and pretending to shoot the gun. And Jennings and Chyna face life in prison if convicted. I've never, ever, I tell you what, I lost my job if I was a detective on that case. I'd beat the fuck out of those people. I've never heard of such a thing. You staple your kid to the wall and use them as target practice while you're sitting there getting high or smoking your meth or doing whatever you're doing. And let me tell you that the CO2 cartridges, that's not a BB gun like I had shooting the windows out in the barn. That son of a bitch, you can kill. That's the CO2 cartridges is basically a pellet gun. Most BB guns are pellet guns. You can put a little metal pellet and instead of being a round BB, it's like a basically like a bullet. And that CO2 fires it out, and that's what killed this baby. And thank God.
Baby, and he's 6 years old. I mean, what a tragic life. I mean, who knows when it started? His entire life could have been enduring, that kind of treatment every single day.
I'm sure it was. And the only great thing about it is he's in heaven and isn't hurting anymore. So, fuck.
And is Michigan not a death penalty? Death penalty. Because I can't imagine anything worse than that. And that's they're going for life.
Must not be a death penalty state. Because if two people deserve it, his own mama, the boyfriend can just be a sick fuck when your own mama does it to you.
Yeah, it's awful. But, I guess that's about the only way we can go into the Nittany Lions segment by saying it'll be uplifting compared to our prior story. But let's talk about where we are. In last week's Nittany Lions segment, we discussed episode 7 of With the Benefit of Hindsight, my true crime podcast series with investigative reporter John Ziegler regarding the Penn State scandal of 2011-2012. In that episode, we discussed leaks by a grand jury investigation into possible child sex abuse by former Penn State assistant coach Jerry Sandusky. Those leaks were provided to a Cub reporter by the name of Sarah Ganim, who worked at a local paper in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That happened in March of 2011. At the time of the leaks, the state had Aaron Fisher, who we talked about last week. He's victim number one, who had claimed abuse by Sandusky. And they also had Mike McQueary, the former Penn State player and currently, back in 2011, Penn State assistant coach, who claimed to have witnessed Sandusky and a boy in a Penn State shower doing, quote, something of a sexual nature back in what they thought was 2002. We discussed Ziegler's belief that Ganim was basically a useful idiot who was used by prosecutors to advertise the need for more victims to come forward. We know specifically that Ganim had direct contact with both Dawn Fisher Hennessy, who was the mother of Aaron Fisher, and Deborah McCord, who's the mother of Zach Constis, who becomes victim number 6. He's the boy who was from the 1998 incident who was held up by Sandusky in the shower. Ganim's specific written warning to Deborah McCord became a matter of public record when she stated, quote, if more victims aren't located soon, this case is going to go away. The metaphor for the episode that we used was a fishing expedition, that this became a fishing expedition after the investigators had those three victims. Prosecutors needed more victims, and they went aggressively door to door trying to find them. When I say aggressively door to door, they had the list of former Second Mile members. Remember, quote unquote, victims are always a decade or so older than they were when the abuse was supposedly taking place. So they're in their, other than Aaron Fisher, they're in their 20s and mid-20s. So the metaphor was a fishing expedition. And Woody very fairly questioned me on why we viewed this as something out of the ordinary when just about any case like this, investigators would be searching, to see if there are additional victims. And that's certainly fair enough. And Ziegler's point was that these additional victims were brought forward by lawyers and therapists after each of them had already been interviewed by police and told them that Sandusky had never touched them. And so the victims that come forward are all people who were interviewed by police, told the police they were not abused by Sandusky, didn't have anything negative to say about Sandusky. Then after this, Ziegler calls it the bat signal, you can call it advertising, but after the leak and the articles by Sarah Ganim and the direct communication with the two lead moms, these other victims come forward and they have lawyers and therapists already.
Let me interrupt you real quick on the Sarah Ganim part. You know, certainly she said what she said in the email, like the case is going to die if we don't get more victims to come forward. I know the way y'all are looking at it, that's her, you know, fishing to, you know, try to keep it alive, da da da. Which, you know what, the truth is, she made a completely true statement. If they didn't have victims come forward, then the case was going to be over. It didn't mean she was doing it with malice or she's like, oh my God, I got to get these moms to get people out of data. She made a very true statement. If you don't have victims, you don't have a case. But you can look at it any way you want to. I'm just saying that if you look at it from another point of view, you know, that's a very true and correct statement. And just like the cops going door to door, but the cops doing what cops do. They interviewed everybody in the Second Mile program. Why? Because that's your job. It's not fishing, but go ahead.
Well, I agree. And that's why, you know, the term I used was useful idiot. I mean, I don't think Ganim was experienced enough to sense that she was being used or manipulated in any way. She got the information and having the information and believing that there was a monster out there, she logically went and did what she could do that she felt right about doing to try and advance the story and bring more victims to the table. It's a repeated theme throughout this. There are some people wearing white hats who actually should have been wearing black hats, but there are a lot of people who are just going about doing what they think is right and doing their jobs because they believe there is a monster that has to be taken down. And because of that, they take action and their action is consistent with believing the story. There are only a select few people, in my opinion, that throughout this process really come to understand the truth, that don't do anything about the fact that they understand the truth. Woody, do you know why I want to learn more Italian?
Why, I go?
Because my niece is getting married next month, and that means a wedding full of these crazy Italians from out of town.
Huh. And when it comes to learning a new language, there's only one leader, Rosetta Stone.
Rosetta Stone's the most trusted language learning program, period. I've come a good ways using Rosetta Stone, but it's time to take it to the next level. My niece's wedding will be great prep for a trip I want to take next year.
Rosetta Stone is the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. No English translations. Rosetta Stone helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's designed for long-term retention.
And the True Accent feature is like having a personal trainer for your accent. Lifetime membership has all 25 of the languages for the rest of your life. That's lifetime access to all 25 language courses Rosetta Stone offers for 50% off.
There's no better time than right now to get started. Listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today.
That's 50% off, unlimited access to 25 languages for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Do you want to set your child up for success? Is your child
Make
struggling with a specific subject
learning,
or need help with a subject?
IXL now.
Is your child ahead,
real life,
not getting challenged enough in class?
Get an exclusive
IXL Learning is an online learning program that enriches your homeschool
today
curriculum. It offers practice in math, English,
today.
Language arts,
visit
science, and social studies while adopting
today
to each child,
to get the most
meeting them where they are.
Program
Plus,
out there
IXL
at the best
encourages
price.
Students to be curious and empowers them how to choose to learn. Now, Cindy used IXL in the classroom as a teacher and now uses it to homeschool our youngest son in the 9th grade. The videos are what she finds that benefits him most in math because he's a very visual learner. The perfect supplement to your homeschool curriculum, IXL offers interactive practice problems, educational game lessons, and video tutorials for every topic you're teaching at home. It's easy to use, time-saving, and everything on IXL is organized by grade, subject, topic, and subtopic, making it simple to find activities for the exact skills you're covering. Instant grading, helpful progress reporting. IXL offers instant feedback and explanations of new topics as kids use the program. Flexible and personalized. Kids can explore any topic in any grade level. They aren't forced into a single learning path like they are on other programs. If you're homeschooling your child because they were falling behind or because they were too far ahead, IXL is a great program to help them get the exact support they need. It's fun for kids, and kids love IXL's positive feedback, awards, and educational games. And it's trustworthy. IXL is trusted by 15 million students worldwide and has proven to improve performance in over 75 scientific research studies. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Real Life Real Crime listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/today. Visit IXL.com/today to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
Most people are doing what they think is the right thing to do, and Sarah Ganim included at that point. So Ziegler's point was that additional victims were brought forward by lawyers and therapists after each of them had been interviewed by the police and said they had never been touched by Sandusky and only came to see themselves as victims after a certain amount of time with lawyers and therapists. So the stories of each of these victims changed after their time spent with the lawyers and the therapists. So in episode 8 of With the Benefit of Hindsight that we're discussing today, we learn that Ziegler's version of the events that led him to identifying the name of victim 2, the boy in the shower from the McQueary episode, and sharing the story of victim 2, Alan Myers' long association with Jerry Sandusky. There's a lot to talk about with victim 2, and at trial, as we'll learn, the prosecution claimed that victim 2 was, quote, known only to God. They claimed that they didn't know who this boy, now young man, was when they absolutely did. So yeah. Any thoughts on that?
I do have one thought on something, and I've been remiss not to mention this before, and not throwing shade, but we never use the victims' names in cases like this. If they're reluctant to come forward to begin with, and most of the time it's because they don't want, they're grown men or whatever now, and they don't want to be seen. First of all, they got duped, and then they don't want to be seen as gay or a dick sucker. I hate to use those terms, but that's the truth. And so we never use their names. And I want to know, I guess, how did they get all of these names, and how did y'all release them to the public?
Okay, so first of all, not until after the trial are any names known. But you brought up a really important point. Throughout all the press before the trial, they were referring to these people as victim 1, victim 2, victim 3, when they should have been accuser 1, accuser 2, accuser 3, because Sandusky is innocent until proven guilty, but the terminology used around the accusers was victim in every case. What we are doing here is...
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll give you that, but that it's in the history of the world, they never listed it as accuser. They always listed it as victims. That's just the way it's done. And I guess, you hit me kind of hard on that one because, you're innocent until proven guilty, but that's just the way it is. They say victim 1, victim 2 in every case that I've ever worked. I guess it is accuser, but I don't know. I don't know what the answer is to that.
Alleged victim 1. I don't know. Something more appropriate than what they did, I think. But the names that we are using now, we got the names because somebody on the Penn State Board of Trustees leaked all of the settlements. And by the way, at trial, they were referred to as victims, but they did use their name. Their names were in the public record. So you could have their name. What we end up getting is the actual settlements, which comes in a little bit. We have an episode where we literally go through how much money each of these guys got. But But so we're now after the trial here, as we're talking
before we go on. In past episodes, you talked about them leaking the grand jury to Sarah Ganim. And then here y'all are, the benefit of somebody leaking something to you.
That's after Sandusky
it's
is convicted and
it's
in prison.
Still a leak. And you used it, you know, I mean, she used it. She just thought she got blessed with the story of her career. And I mean, I'm just saying, I mean, leaks happen every day and I've used them. Everybody's used them. And that's just part of it. Right. So if it's keep it on the even playing field.
Yeah.
Leaks,
so
leaks,
I guess, whatever, the difference,
whatever reason,
difference.
I mean, y'all, your reason to get it would be to tell your story or what you think your story is and what.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if the information was gathered by board members through requests, and then they share that information with us. Maybe what's really inaccurate is me calling it a leak, because it's technically not a leak. It's sharing of information.
You don't want to do that,
right? Where the
you don't want to do that, because now somebody's going to look for that board member that leaked this to Zig and you. So I would take that statement back. Call it something else.
Well, except the board completely turns over, because the board members recognize that Corbett and Surma, who led the board, were the guys who railroaded everybody. And so the board, through a series of elections, rolls all of those people off the board and gets honorable people on it. And the honorable people are the ones who want to see the truth come out. So again, I think if they, as long as they had, which I believe they did, the right to have that information, I don't think there was an issue in them sharing it, which of course we're talking years after trial now, because the settlements don't start happening until he's a convicted man, right? So he's already in prison as this is happening. But anyway, the state's beefed up its roster of victims now. They have 8 victims at trial. Only 6 of which were actual people that we talked about, right? They didn't have a victim 2, and they didn't have a victim 8. That was the janitor case. 4 of the victims are good friends that were seen in one photograph in Sandusky's book called Touched. The Attorney General, Linda Kelly's press conference back in November of 2011, she tells the story of the grad assistant, who we know now as Mike McQuarrie, witnessing Sandusky, quote, having anal sex with a boy believed to be around 10 years old in the Penn State showers. During that same press conference, she shares that, quote, we have no idea who victim 2 is. Penn State administrators made no attempt to find him, and we have been unable to locate him. We are asking for him to please come forward. So inside of her comments at the press conference, she's asking for victim number 2, the boy in the shower, to come forward. Ziegler has email correspondence from investigator Anthony Sassano stating to the chief investigator from the AG's office, Janelle Eschbach, that once they arrest Sandusky, a bunch more victims are going to come forward. That was their thesis, which made sense.
I've said it in every case, period. And so, that statement is, it's true. But evidently,
their thesis, logically, again, good actors doing what they believe is the right thing, even if they're a little bit shaky on McQuarrie's story, if they're a little bit shaky on Aaron Fisher, they are convinced that once they arrest Sandusky, a bunch of additional, let's say, high victims are going to come forward, right? But no victim 2 comes forward. And, you know, it's kind of impossible to believe that victim 2 would be unaware that Sandusky's been arrested, unless, you know, somehow he was, the kid had died between the incident and 2011, or was living outside the country, maybe. But there's seemingly no reason for victim 2 to be afraid of Sandusky at that
point.
There's a reason.
And it's not that he's at this time afraid of Sandusky. It's that he didn't want to be known. Now, like, y'all got the names and the whole world knows them. He didn't want, if it happened to me, I wouldn't want my name out in the public. I wouldn't want to have to go to court and testify for no amount of money. Do I want to say I got butt fucked in the shower when I was a boy, and it went on for however long, and he groomed me, and I was in this relationship with him. I thought it was normal. You damn right, I wouldn't have come for it. So,
okay, but you now know that that's not the reason he didn't come forward.
I know. I don't know what the reason was at this time. I'm saying if it was me, that I wouldn't have come forward. I just wouldn't have. As a man, I'm not coming forward and saying that all this shit happened to me for any amount of money. So,
okay. Well, I think that maybe you're an exception to the rule here in central Pennsylvania anyway, is people were coming forward because they had already lined up lawyers and therapists and found out that there was going to be considerable money. But even with that going on, there is no victim to that comes forward. And so Ziegler's thesis is he can't come up with a logical reason why he wouldn't be coming forward when these other alleged victims came forward, especially since Sandusky is now under house arrest. And if there was fear of Sandusky, it would be minimized with that being the case.
I don't think anybody had fear of Sandusky being violent or doing anything. I mean, he was an old man. If they didn't come forward, it was for other reasons. Now, like you said, some people come, the other ones coming forward with lawyers and all that shit. I bet you to this date that there's still some people that haven't come forward that the investigators never knew about. So if this is true, but Sandusky can't hurt anybody. The only thing they can get hurt is their image as a human being, as a man. And having been duped into being that, especially the more people that come forward. Now, the one guy, when they leave the recorder on and they're like, oh, the lawyer says, can we tell him about the other people and get him pissed off?
By the way, I realized that you misunderstood me. At the point that they told him that, they didn't have.
Yeah. I saw that, but they had some. They
lied to him. They didn't have a single person saying conclusively that they had been
conclusively abused they by had Sandusky when they told them saying that something did. Though they wouldn't have been investigated. They had something, Mike, or they wouldn't have been investigated.
Woody, they had the grand jury investigating Fisher, but Fisher hadn't yet told a story to the grand jury that detailed abuse. So they did not have a single report on record of somebody being abused when they told outs that they did, who is victim. And so back to victim two for a second is, so this thing goes on here where trial happens. No victim two has come forward during the trial. And we find out that in advance of the trial, Marine Corps sergeant by the name of Alan Myers, who was Second Mile member, hears the story and recognizes that it must be him that they're talking about based upon what is coming out in the press. And so he first, over the summer, had sent, when the first leak came out in March and people were accusing Sandusky, he had sent letters to two newspapers and a letter to the attorney general with his name saying that Sandusky had never touched him. He knew him extremely well, that these others were lying, that it couldn't possibly be true that Sandusky had abused anyone. It before the trial and after having written the letters, Alan Myers goes to Sandusky's attorney, Joe Amendola, goes to see Amendola with his mother and gives a sworn statement to their investigator saying that he's the boy in the shower. He knows things only the boy in the shower could know. He knows about slamming of a locker door. He knows some specifics that the slapping that nobody other than the boy in the shower could know. And he goes on to say that he and Jerry were having a towel snapping fight in the shower after a long day of traveling across the state for Jerry doing book signings, that they took a workout and then grabbed a shower afterward, that Jerry never touched him that day nor any other day. So Amendola, the attorney, has a very false sense of confidence that they are going to blow this entire case up. He's got victim two, and nobody knows who victim two is, supposedly, and he's got him, and he's having conversations with both victim number three, Jason Simcisco, and victim number six, Zach Constas, where they are both wavering in conversation as well, because they're saying they're only going along because of what other people are saying, right? So he thinks that he's going to win this case. He thinks he's got the smoking gun witness in victim number two. He agrees to do an interview with Bob Costas. Not only does he do the interview with Bob Costas himself, where he tells Costas that they have found victim two, that victim two says nothing ever happened, that he anticipates that several other of these alleged victims are going to change their story and say nothing ever happened. And Costas asks him if he can interview Sandusky. And he agrees to let Costas interview Sandusky, which turns out to be a disaster for Sandusky, based upon a question that Costas asks him that gets, the conversation isn't long, but what gets played throughout most of the news is this particular segment where Costas asks, are you sexually attracted to young boys? And Sandusky repeats the question, am I sexually attracted to underage boys? Sexually attracted? No. I enjoy young people. I love to be around them. But no, I'm not sexually attracted to young boys. The way that he delivered his answer, there's probably more of a delay than there was a delay of him thinking how to answer, and then him repeating the question, and then finishing as I quoted there. People heard that and thought it was creepy as hell, thought he absolutely sounded like a predator, and it was sort of a nail in Sandusky's coffin when it had been set up by his own attorney as an opportunity to kind of prove his innocence. Well, it really blows up when, before the trial takes place, Andrew Shubin, who is the local attorney that is representing a bunch of these victims, notifies Amendola's office that he is representing victim two, Alan Myers, and Alan's changed his story and he is now a victim. So somewhere between the time victim two comes forward and signs this statement saying that he was the boy in the shower, that he was never touched by Sandusky that night or any other night, after he had written the letters to the attorney general and to the newspapers, somewhere after all of that, he has found this attorney, Shubin, and has changed his story.
Well, I mean, people change their stories, and he was a Marine sergeant. And again, look at the history they had afterwards, his entire life. And you could think, you say, oh, well, that's Sandusky just being a good father-like figure to this, you know, a one-time troubled kid. And now they took a photograph of the wedding, whatever. If you look at it from the other perspective, and Sandusky is a mastermind pedophile, that in each one of these victims' cases, he seemed to keep contact with them throughout their adult life. I would say that that is his way of controlling them even into the adult life. Maybe Sandusky believed that he really had that relationship with them, that they were that tight, and he's exerted, if he doesn't show up for a wedding or whatever, keep the contact, then the kid might come out and say, I was duped, right? So you look at it both ways.
Okay, but stay with that for a second. If that's the case, the kid suddenly realizes that, yeah, I was a victim too. I was abused by Sandusky. Maybe it wasn't that night in the shower with the McQuarrie incident, but it was other things. Why does the prosecution decide not to use him when he is arguably the most important victim because he's the one tied to the McQuarrie episode? Why does he not testify?
It's either one of two things. One, they're dirty, or two, first of all, he says, oh, I must be victim number two, the boy in the shower, because I only know things only that I could know. Like, I heard a locker door slam. How many fucking locker doors you hear slam in a locker room? I mean, it could have been, it doesn't mean he's victim number two. I mean, but they're, assuming that he's victim number two because he heard the noises that they described, whatever. Let's say he assumes he's victim number two. And then afterwards, and he writes the letters and the support and everything else. And he gets the attorney. The attorney tells him all the shit that they have against Sandusky. And he was like, you know what? Motherfucker played me my entire life. And I might as well get paid too, because now I'm going to tell the fucking truth and come forward. Well, the problem with that is he's already told the prosecution and the state's attorney general, it wasn't, never happened to me. And now they're looking at it and they're like, fuck it. I can't put him on a stand. They can look at it as perjury. So I get it. It looks bad on the prosecution and them saying he's known only to God. Well, I suspect their defense is going to be he really wasn't who we think victim number two was.
Okay. Well, that's plausible. They decide at trial to claim that they've looked all over for him. They haven't been able to find victim number two, and his name is, quote, known only to God.
It looks very shitty. It looks very shitty on the prosecution, but you can believe whether it was on appeal or whatever, you know, fucking, first of all, Sandusky had the dumbest fucking lawyer in the world. it comes up on appeal or whatever. The prosecution has a simple explanation of, we do not believe he's victim number two. We do not believe he's the one. And this is the reason why. But it does look shady as fuck.
Well, and especially when you realize that they bought these crazy stories like victim number eight, but the only person they don't believe is victim number two, who they blatantly accused his attorney of having written his statement, victim number two having written it. Anyway, so at trial, there's no victim number two. Again, ironically, Sandusky gets convicted on 45 of 49 counts. The only counts he's not convicted of are the counts tied to victim two and the abuse count tied to victim six. He did get convicted of grooming, something vaguely resembling grooming in the case of victim six, right?
You can't convict someone you don't have, if their accuser, I mean, you have a right to confront your accuser, et cetera. If there's no victim two presented at trial, you're never going to get a conviction.
Well, they convicted him of victim eight, and there's no victim presented at trial for victim eight.
They had whatever the testimony, which I thought was bullshit. And at that point, they're throwing against the wall, and that part stuck, but they didn't say. I know they said it was victim number two that it happened to also as part of the story, but
McQuarrie testified.
I understand, but the McQuarrie testified, and I understand the older guy, the janitor's story too. Yeah, you know, just that's why they
didn't get convicted. I'm just telling
you that on number eight, and I'm giving it to you. The victim number two wasn't there, and you know, whether they hit him, like they saying they hit him in the cabin during the trial and all this bullshit, I don't know. But he's not there. So Sandusky didn't get convicted of it. I mean, that's exactly what you just said.
Right. But my point is a very valid one, which is the same jury decided to convict on hearsay testimony about another victim they can't identify in number eight. And they had direct witness testimony for victim number two, yet they decided not to convict. So you can only, I think, conclude from that the jury just simply didn't believe McQuarrie's story.
Right.
Otherwise, they would have convicted.
I don't believe it. McQuarrie's story, and I said that before, and I'll say it again on the record. I also don't believe he was having sex in the shower with anyone at Penn State because he's too smart for that.
So let's go forward to just after the trial.
If people are dieting now more than ever before, why are nearly one in three American adults overweight? Dr. Gundry, who's helped thousands lose weight and feel younger and healthier, says most people are not getting enough fat-burning MCTs from their food. MCTs are a special kind of compound that doesn't turn into fat when you consume it. Instead, it turns into a chemical that breaks down the excess fat in your body.
So getting more MCTs in your diet is like flipping a switch that puts your body in caloric bypass mode, which flushes out excess fat and calories. And Dr. Gundry has created an easy way for you to activate caloric bypass right at home. It's called MCT Wellness. This powerful blend of fat-flushing MCT powders and antioxidant-rich polyphenols is designed to help you unlock your body's fat-burning, energy-producing potential. What's even better is that it comes in a tasty drink form. It actually tastes good. All you do is add a scoop to water, enjoy, and watch as you start feeling slimmer and more energized.
So you want to experience a quick, easy, and effective way to melt pounds fast? Go to GundryMD.com/RLRC and order right now to get up to 53% off your regular price order with a 90-day money-back guarantee. And again, that's GundryMD.com/RLRC.
Awesome.
All right, good deal.
Hey, everybody, it's Aggo. Listen up, especially you ladies over 40. I've got some good news. It's called Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is an all-in-one hormonal balancing solution. It relieves symptoms of menopause. It promotes healthy weight loss and curbs cravings. It improves sleep quality. It reduces bloating and gas. It relieves hot flashes. It can even relieve occasional mood swings, although nothing like that has ever happened in my house. Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalance should take it, but it's perfect for the horrible menopause symptoms that make you put your life on hold. For a limited time, you can get 15% off on your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use code RLRC at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and code RLRC at checkout for 15% off today. Just after the trial, it comes out that victim number two has surfaced. His name is Alan Myers. He is the boy in the shower. He is claiming abuse at the hands of Sandusky. He has Andrew Shubin as well as a very fancy law firm representing him. And this becomes a major news item post-trial. No one's questioning where he was during the trial, just that he's decided to come out now for whatever reason. And the big evidence is recording of a voicemail message that Sandusky has left on Alan Myers' phone. And that message was left in the summer, either late August or early September, by Sandusky on the phone of Alan Myers. And what Sandusky says in that voicemail, he ends it with "love ya." But the conversation, the message is with regards to somebody wanting to talk to Alan Myers about the case. He says, you should go forward and just talk to them. You have nothing to hide. Just tell them what you know. And if you need more info, call me back. Take care. Love you. That's the message.
And looking at it from the other direction, again, if he had this relationship, even if it stopped being sexual after a certain age, and he's in his life the whole time, da 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 da, and he knows that they're going to go talk to him as alleged victim two or whatever, that phone call could be a simple measure of control. Hey, if you're thinking from not your side, Sandusky controlling and say, hey, they're coming to talk to you, go ahead and talk to him, right? And basically keep your story straight. But I know you're not going to sell me out. You got to look at it. You can look at it from both ways.
You can. But you have to do that with every single one of these people. So if you're Ziegler and you're looking for something that tells you Sandusky's guilty because you just want this to be over. You got involved because you didn't believe the Paterno cover-up story, and that has essentially been debunked by this point in time. And you got sucked in, and now you're just looking for something that can make you feel in your gut like you know this guy is guilty. And none of these stories is proof that he wasn't a pedophile, but none of them are proof that he was. And there's no physical evidence, and you have all these peculiarities like four best friends and this situation with all of these people involved where they maintained relationships with him. And McQueary not only maintains a relationship with Sandusky after supposedly seeing him raping a boy in a shower, he's attending the golf tournaments of the Second Mile. He's at a fundraiser clowning around with Sandusky. He questions at one point why Sandusky is being allowed to be around the program, but only does that after the police have come to him and questioned him about the incident from 10 years earlier. And so all of these people are carrying on normal relationships with Jerry Sandusky. Alan Myers is like a son to Jerry Sandusky, if you look at the relationship based upon the facts that you can gather. Ask Jerry to stand as his father at his final high school football game. He drives, 12 hours each way from the Marine Corps to attend Jerry's mother's funeral. Jerry and Dottie attend Myers' wedding. Myers stays at the Sandusky home while he's taking summer classes at Penn State. This is a very longstanding fatherly type relationship that, look, I'm not an expert. So maybe you're going to tell me, Mike, there are lots of cases of abuse where that relationship is maintained for life long after the abuse. And okay, that wouldn't be possible with me, but
I wouldn't say numerous. I wouldn't say numerous ones, but I'm saying it is a possibility that is his MO, because it happened in almost every one of these cases where he maintains this lifelong relationship. And they, if he is a pedophile, and then that's how he operated. He kept them close throughout his life, and maybe he believed that he truly did love them, and the sex was, or the rape was part of it or whatever, but he kept them close throughout the life. Almost every one of these is the same thing. Father figure, went to the weddings and, funerals, whatever the fuck. They did things together. They wrote him letters later on in life, and he's certainly going to maintain contact. I don't know. I'm just throwing that from the other side.
Well, do you remember the part in the story where in 2016, so we're now 5 years down the road from all this, Sandusky has an appeal hearing, and it's the first time that Alan Myers is slated to testify against Sandusky in that appeal hearing. And 34 times in the questioning of Myers, he says, "I don't remember." He's shown a picture taken with Dottie and Jerry and him and his bride at his wedding. Yep. And he says, "I don't remember."
Let me interrupt you on that. I had it happen in a homicide case. The guy was on tape, and he went in. He was part of the murder, but it was two guys that did the murder. He was part of the murder, and he went into the prosecution and flipped. Went on tape, and the prosecution, even days before trial, they went over his testimony, and that motherfucker got on the stand, and he said, "I don't remember, I don't remember, I don't remember." And the DA that lost his Jesus, he's like, "Is this not your voice on the tape? And did we not meet 2 days ago? And you told me all this, this, and this." He's like, "I don't remember. I don't remember." And so he ended up prosecuting his ass and putting him in prison too. So people do that. And then Myers get on the stand saying, "I don't remember." It could have been, "Fuck, I don't want to tell all these people, what happened." And what, I mean, it's speculation. Who knows why he said
it. He's asked where he was during the trial.
"I don't remember.
He responds, "I don't remember.
I get it." And he's shown a photo of that he knows he's in or whatever, where it was taken at. He says, "I don't remember." Well, you know what? I'm not saying. I know he remembers, right? And he's lying his ass off. We will never know exactly why he was lying. Right. It could be because he got on that guy in the murder case, got on a stand and got in front of the other guy and his partner. And he was like, "Fuck it. I'm not saying anything." Now the guy, I got to see him face to face, and I'm going to be known as a rat. But I'm not saying that Myers was thinking he's going to be a rat. But what reason? Well, I get up there and basically that's a hostile witness at that point. I mean, when you get up there and say, I don't remember, and you know you're lying, you're invalidating yourself as a witness.
The judge came out before Myers was brought out as a witness and went to Sandusky and said, are you sure you want him to come out, Alan Myers, to come out as a witness? And Sandusky said, yes, I insist that he come out as a witness. I insist he look me in the eye and he testify. Now,
yeah, and the judge told him, nothing good's going to come out of
it. It's not going to be good for you.
Not going to be good for you, motherfucker. And dumbass Amendola or whatever the attorney's name.
No, at that time he had a different attorney, Lindsay.
Whoever. They were fucking stupid for letting that happen, but it, you know, whatever.
Well, but I think
I know it worked out for him. It worked. I don't remember, you know, it's different evidently than what the guy said in the judge's chambers. You know, he got up there and was like, fuck it, I'm not saying anything. It might be because he's sitting in front of Sandusky.
I think to this day, he continues to believe that the one who is going to break is going to be Myers. That Myers is the one who is at some point going to not be able to deal with life anymore, or live in this lie, and is going to break. Myers is the one, you know, who Sandusky absolutely, the whole family, not just Jerry, thought of as a son. And we'll see how that kind of plays in later episodes.
Hey, I got a question for you. I don't really want to tell this part, but there's a case of a person sitting on death row in Texas. And I have the entire case file. I have everything. And I don't believe it happened as they said it happened. But I don't believe the person is totally innocent either. And probably the main reason, I'm talking about, I have personal contact with this motherfucker, like could go visit with him and shit on death row. But the one reason I'm not fucking with it is because I have a great fear that when they strap that motherfucker to the table, like a lot of them do at the last second, they're going to say, I better get right with Jesus and try to get right with the victims' families. And they're going to state exactly what their part was. And it's going to make me look like a fool. Right. And what I'm not wishing bad on you or anything, but you better pray to God that Sandusky doesn't get on. He's never going to get on the death table, but that he's not on his deathbed and all of a sudden has, because you said he doesn't lie and all that, and all of a sudden he has the conscience, I want to clear my conscience, and admits to everything.
That is never going to happen.
You sleep good tonight. You're not worried about that happening, right?
Realize that they offered this guy, so he was sentenced to 30 to 60 years. They offered him a plea deal down to 10 years. Yep. He's already been in prison 13 years.
Okay? Yep.
He would have been out.
Yep.
They offered, he refused. He has fought this and fought this and fought this through. And there now is a tremendous group of people supporting him, paying his legal bills, that believe that are people from around the Penn State program that believe deeply in his innocence, that are funding his lawyers and his further appeals, because he doesn't have any money left and it continues to go. And so he's going to keep fighting, and eventually it's going to get into a federal court. And when it does, that's when this thing is going to turn around, because that's when the Snedden investigation, which we talked about in episode 4, where you have the Obama administration finding out about what's happening at Penn State, and they have Graham Spanier, Penn State's president, who has a very high level government security clearance. They've got to determine whether they need to renew that clearance or get rid of that clearance, because if Spanier's part of a cover up of child abuse, they got to get rid of him. Snedden does that investigation. 6 months he investigates this case, and his conclusion is to call it the Penn State goat screw and say that Sandusky is innocent. And so that's the most thorough investigation into this case that has been done, and it was conclusive in its findings, and it's not been piece of Pennsylvania deliberations in this case. It's when all of these millionaires who are tied to these lies are gone. Sandusky, unfortunately, probably be gone too. But when they are, and somebody objective looks at this, It's just, I hear you that there's plausible reasons for a lot of these things that happen. You've taken one-on-one, one at a time, and yeah, it's plausible that this with Aaron Fisher, and it's plausible this with victim two, and it's plausible this with how it's victim four, and it's plausible this with victim five. Well, I don't know what's plausible with victim five, but there's something plausible with each. But when you wrap them all together, and then you also wrap the whole repressed memory thing around everything, which was the excuse used for why stories changed, but you should believe the new story, not the old story. It just, there's no beef. There's no physical proof of anything. And there's no proof of anything from any other, there's no accusations of anything from any other part of Jerry Sandusky's life. So it's like there's this confined period in this guy's life when he becomes this monster. And, you know, he launched this charity in 1979, but he waits 19 years before he does anything to anyone inside of that charity. And then all of these people line up and they all have therapists and they all have lawyers and they all get paid. This guy got paid $6.9 million, victim two.
Hey, let me tell you where the proof is. And it's a matter of public record. The proof in this case is inside the jurors' minds when they came back and found him guilty of 43 counts. That's all that matters. And that's the truth. I'm going along with it. We're going to continue the series. And I hope, you know what? Sandusky is innocent. Let him go. I totally agree with that, but I'm not saying that. I mean, I don't think he's innocent thus far, but I'm still listening. Yeah, there's a lot of shitty shit in this case. You know what? There's shitty shit in every case. We're going to continue it, and hopefully, I mean, if he's innocent, hopefully he gets released. I mean, I don't want an innocent person in prison. Nobody wants an innocent person in prison. And then the whole world should give him a big fat apology if he's proven innocent. Guess what? Right now he's proven guilty. And that's just the facts. Well,
a jury found him guilty. Yes. Of 45 Absolutely. Counts. But that's cool. Juries get shit wrong all the time.
Oh, and, yep. That's true too.
So, all fair enough. Look, we just keep banging away at the individual pieces here and see if we get you over the threshold at some point here. So,
all right. I enjoy it. And you know, hopefully you can get me over the threshold. I mean, no, if you get me over the fucking threshold, then hopefully they let Sandusky out of prison. How about that?
They're not going to do that.
Yeah. Well,
they're not going to do that because you got this guy that was almost the vice presidential nominee, Josh Shapiro. He's dirty in this. It's the corruption in that state.
Yeah,
it is the most corrupt state in the country. The corruption is deep.
People
it's
say the same
scary.
Thing about Louisiana and the corruption and the politics. But you know what? Yeah, I know some of the lies there. But I'm going to say, I'm going to end it with this. I've said it before. You can't make me believe that for whatever reason, all these people colluded to put Sandusky in prison when all these counts. Everybody just got together for political reasons and money reasons and whatever and said, let's get this.
They didn't collude to get him. He's collateral damage. The collusion was at the top. It was Corbett, who's the governor at the time, and John Surma, who was the CEO of U.S. Steel at the time, who wanted Graham Spanier's ass. This whole thing.
You think there's an easier way to get Graham Spanier's ass than to come up with 45 or 48 counts of molestation against Jerry Sandusky? Hell, you could frame him with a fucking prostitute. Plant some dope in his car. That's easier than that.
Woody, the plan never included it going where it ended up going. They just wanted to get him fired. And they got him fired. Yeah. But it lit up this shitstorm that Sandusky got swept up in and Paterno got swept. They didn't want to get Paterno. Remember the very first story that came out positioned Paterno as a hero for having gone to Curley and Schultz right away. So they had carefully crafted this thing. There was a target on one head. It was on the president of Penn State's head, Graham Spanier. And when they shot the gun, they killed Paterno with it. And then Paterno's family decided they had to separate Paterno from Sandusky. And then the board that had fired them all needed the bullshit story to be true. And so they needed victims and they recruited them.
Let me give you some advice as a security professional. That now that you're calling out all of these people that had this master plan to do all this, that window behind you, don't sit in front of anymore because they're going to come take you out. They go, shoot you, Mike. And then I'm going to have to come work your fucking homicide.
You know what? By the way, you have my permission to work. I'll leave.
I'm going to get you a role in Kristen first.
Yes, and absolutely.
And then I'm going to work your homicide and I'll solve it.
I will leave word that I specifically want you working the case. And that may be the more pleasant end than this fight, which is now 5 years for me and a lot longer for Ziegler's. But we continue. Yeah. And I appreciate the work you're putting in because, man, there's a lot and a lot of detail to this case. And
it's hard for fucking people to hear this. I mean, it really is. And people, I always tell people, you know what? You don't want a fucking jury trial because somebody's going to on the jury. You're going to get 12 regular people on a jury who go to church every Sunday or whatever, have regular jobs, and they have kids and grandkids and sisters and brothers or whatever, and they're going to want somebody to pay on these molestation cases. And that's the truth. But people are hearing it and listening to us talk about it and the responses and the stuff in the forums and stuff like that. People don't like to hear shit about molesters, especially molesters being innocent. And that's where a lot of the stuff's come from. But you know what? We took it on. So there it is.
Look, I fought. I sat down with at least 10 studios in LA that 8 of them loved the story and all 8 said, it's toxic. It's third rail. We're not going there because, and of course that was in the middle of the Me Too movement, but in a case like Weinstein's case, you can look at Weinstein's case and go, okay, there's probably a few of these quote unquote victims that jumped on board the gravy train to get a check, but there's real proof of a number of them. There's physical proof of a number of them having been abused. Whose story do you believe here? Tell me the one victim whose story you believe. Pick one.
Well, you know what? You don't have to believe it. It's the jury that had to believe it. And after reading the courtroom transcripts, the descriptions, any normal person would be pissed off. And that's a fact. And me, I'm somewhat desensitized to it because I did it for a career and I've done all these cases and I've listened to the most heartbreaking shit from these victims. But this man, the direct testimony these victims give on the stand, there's no reason, there's no doubt in my mind why they convicted him beyond a reasonable doubt. So
I think he was convicted before he ever walked into the courtroom.
Well, but he's definitely convicted now though, after the testimony. So, but
yeah, I'll be interested to hear your feedback of the testimony. Cause I think testimony is so obviously bullshit bullshit.
But a reasonable person on the jury had to take that into account and they had to decide, right? And they could say, like the kids say in the soundproof basement, that may be the way he remembered it, but I believe Y and Z that he's saying about this, right? But we'll get into it another day, right?
You got it.
And I love all you lifers. Thank you for liking and sharing and all that good shit. Right. All that good podcast shit.
Awesome. Safe trip to Atlanta. And we'll talk at you next week.
Look, we're going to record. I'm bringing everything with me and we'll record next Thursday morning as usual. But I'll just be doing it from Atlanta.
You got it.
All right. Peace, y'all.
Aglets. Thanks, man.
Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here, reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance, like your first home expansion or your first big lightning strike. There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Families agents. Life's better when you're under American Families roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.